What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Did I kill some of your people, Kempinar?
Why him, you monster? Why not the script girl? The script girl. I'll eat her later.
Just promise me, Josh, you won't touch Golden Joe Dassault.
I'm hungry. Where's the intern?
Oh, man. This week on the show, it's the top five performances by non-professionals. None, I think, actual bloodsuckers as imagined in that movie, Shadow of the Vampire.
We've also got a review of David Gordon Green's Joe with Nicolas Cage and at least one great performance by a non-professional. That and more.
I think you still have a little bit of blood there on your face, Josh.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 20% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM414.
We're also brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to Squarespace.com and use offer code Film. One of our listeners, Josh, Richard W. in Minneapolis, wrote into us and said, I thought I'd email and let you know what an excellent experience my partner and I have had with Squarespace over the last 4 months. We set up the site using the Film Spotting promo code for our self-published book series, The Adventures of Seamus Tripp. The interface is simple, the template designs are cool, and the customer service has been great. You can find the website at SeamusTripp.com, and that's T-R-I-P-P. .com. Richard mentioned some of the great features of Squarespace, including the design. Every one of those designs automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will always look great on every device every time. You can also easily embed videos and trailers of your favorite films and TV shows via the simple YouTube and Vimeo integration, and it is very easy to use, but if you do need help, you can call Squarespace. They've got amazing support that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the whole service starts at just $8 a month, which includes a free domain name if you sign up for 1 year.
You can begin a trial without using a credit card. It's not required. Just start building your website. When you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM to get 10% off and to show your support for Film Spotting. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar with Max Schreck this week. We've been making radio here for nearly 10 years as non-professionals, so we should have an insight or two on the folks who make our top five list this week, performances by non-professionals, people who made a prominent acting debut without the benefit of experience, or maybe with the benefit of no experience, as it turns out. If you're making your mental list right now, note this caveat: no kids, no musicians. That list is later in the show.
But first, what happens when you throw a bunch of non-professional performers in with the acting tsunami known as Nicolas Cage? We'll discuss in our review of Joe.
Hey, mister.
Yeah?
Me and my daddy just got into town. I was wondering if you'd give us a job.
I pay a day's pay for a day's work. And if we work till dinner and get rained out, I pay for the whole day. Does that sound fair enough?
Yes, sir.
I'm Joe. When I watch that boy, I see someone who's nothing like me.
What are you looking at?
Why do you stick around like this?
What's most important right now is me taking care of Dorothy and Mama. Kind of got a family problem right now.
What happened?
He's all beat up.
I can't get my hands dirty in every little thing. You know how I get.
Why you want to go back to the damn penitentiary, man?
Freeze, Joe!
I do want to start our discussion of Joe with that question I posed regarding Nicolas Cage and how his presence may or may not work in a film that's largely populated by non-professional actors. Joe director David Gordon Green has favored regular folks in his film since his debut, George Washington, and pretty much since, save for that run of broad Hollywood comedies he made starting with Pineapple Express. So he's an expert at casting the right faces and at making them work within the story of his films. As unpredictable as it must be working with non-professionals, though, I can't imagine they're as volatile of a commodity as Nicolas Cage, especially the highly theatrical Cage of recent years. Joe brings all of these acting elements together. Cage has the title role, that of a stoic foreman in charge of a ragged crew working a patch of forest in rural Texas. Joe tries to stay at a remove from the harsh, violent, working-class world he's a part of, but that becomes difficult when a 15-year-old boy, played by Ty Sheridan, joins his crew and Joe learns of his abusive relationship with his father. That father's played by Gary Poulter, who had no previous acting experience. Neither did the men who play the members of Joe's crew. So Cage is working with a lot of novices here, not to mention a young actor like Sheridan, who has rich experience, working with Jeff Nichols on Mud and Terrence Malick on The Tree of Life, but not extensive experience. So this is a real stew of acting approaches that Green has going on here, Adam. What did you make of Cage's attempt to mesh with this wide array of co-stars? And overall, do you think the praise that he's largely been getting for what is certainly a quieter performance is well-deserved?
I do think it's well-deserved. I think he meshed really well here, and it's certainly the least amount of acting we've seen from Cage in a long time, and maybe ever, even here when his character gets worked up and has an emotional outburst. It's more subtle. It's grounded. It's less overtly physical, less manic than we've seen Cage in a lot of previous roles. He really uses his frame and that beard and his eyes to be intimidating. And I think it also works, Josh. I think his performance does because of his character's status and his role in the movie. You mentioned that he's the foreman of this crew. It's really his business, it seems. He's hired by someone, but he is running this entire operation. His whole life on the job, outside of the job, revolves around order and structure and applying his knowledge and experience. And that business relies on being able to hire people who are lost in a way. People who, as we hear them talking a little bit, they just need to make a buck. They maybe have few options. They show up on the job maybe if they didn't end up in jail the night before or didn't get too drunk. So their lives are a lot more chaotic than his, and he has to exude control. We learn more of the reasons why as the film goes on. And when we do, we see that that control is actually a little bit of an act even for him. So it makes sense that that performance exudes control and exudes experience. It makes him stand out from that group. So as we do learn more about Joe, we see he's a very, very flawed individual, but he's aware of all those flaws. There's one thing he knows better than anything in life. It's exactly who he is as a man. Could the role have worked just as well or maybe even better with a non-professional playing Joe? Maybe. Anything's possible, but it surely would be vastly different than it is. And I think Cage here serves that character and serves the movie very well.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really strong. And he's not only a guy in control in these various facets of his life, but you can tell early on that he's struggling to stay in control. Mm-hmm. That's a crucial part of it as well. And that's where Cage's background or the idea of Nicolas Cage, I think, helps, because we've seen him blow before. And that's not to make this movie sound simple, where it's you're just waiting for him to go off the deep end. That's not what this is about really at all. But it does play, that danger does play into the part in a good way. That said, I think he somewhat, and maybe it's for the same reason, sticks out a little bit in the scenes where he's the only pro. There's just something, there's a star presence that he has, and as quiet as he tries to dim it down in much of the film, he's a little bit apart. I don't think it throws anything off, mm-hmm. but those scenes where it's just him and his crew and they're kind of sitting around shooting the bull, there's just, you can tell it's still Nicolas
Cage. Sure, but I guess I'm arguing that it is by design a little bit, or it works by design, that he ends up standing out as this rock, as much of a rock in this environment as you can have.
I think he's really excellent, though, in some of the scenes he gets, especially with Sheridan, where maybe they're on a little firmer ground, just having had some of that shared experience, mm-hmm. even though Sheridan is quite a young actor yet. I think those scenes are really good. And what I liked about the movie is it did allow us, it's not one of these where a star with a known quality tries to go in a drastic different direction and to show us that he can do it. And what happens is everything else that star ever brought to a movie gets lost behind, mm-hmm. even the good things. And there's an interlude here where Joe and Gary, who is the boy played by Sheridan, they just go off for a while to find Joe's dog, who's run away. And it turns into this just free-spirited, hanging out, driving around the countryside, joking around, bit of fun that we haven't seen from either of those characters before in the film, and it gets very cagey. It's almost like all of a sudden Nicolas Cage starts forgetting that he's supposed to be this damped down guy. And mm-hmm. David Gordon Green just lets the camera roll and is figuring, let's see how far he's going to take this. It never goes beyond the character, though. And there's a great conversation where he's trying to show Gary how to make a cool face and what that means and how you do it. And that could be something from one of Cage's great early works where it's this loose, unhinged guy a little bit, and you never know what he's going to say next. I thought that was a great part of the film.
Though it's funny to me that you chose the one scene there to highlight where he is the most cagey, and it's the one that did stick out to me because of that and stuck out as a little bit distracting.
Beyond the character, really?
Beyond the character a little bit, even though he is supposed to be very clearly drunk, and we do kind of expect him to take on maybe a little bit of a bigger persona. But I guess I was a little bit more fascinated by his quieter scenes, and a lot of his scenes here are quiet. And I think as we talk about that character and having to be constantly under control, I love how David Gordon Green chooses to emphasize certain aspects of his life, like we see him paying his workers, not just paying mm-hmm. his workers, but rounding up the money and writing out the receipts and how much they get paid. And clearly, I think that's by design on the director's part to show us how there is this system and this order to his life. And as long as he keeps that routine, as long as he maintains that order and counts out that money every day or every week like he's supposed to, he'll be fine. Or if he maintains the routine of just sitting on the couch or laying on the couch every night watching TV, the same mind-numbing programming, somehow deadening himself, whether it's through alcohol or just not allowing for anything provocative to take hold of him, he'll be okay. And David Gordon Green talked about in my interview with him last week about the movie fundamentally being about restraint. What I wrote in my notes during the screening that I saw was what you gotta do versus what you want to do. And that instinct seems to be what he is always fighting and trying to teach at some point Gary, I believe, as well, this young kid, as you mentioned. In this world we see, in this world of Joe, those are two completely different things. And you're always fighting that instinct and that conflict and that portrait of a man that we get here, unable to completely close himself off from the world as much as he wants to, is what held this whole movie together for me, even when some other elements distracted me.
I think that money scene also speaks to the sense of fairness that Joe has.
Right.
He makes it clear that they're going to get paid for the work that they do. They do good work. He's not going to cheat them. And we see him doing that, delivering on his promises. And that echoes into his larger sense of correcting things that are wrong. And that's really what gets him in trouble, is this deep need to do that, at least what he feels mm-hmm. is wrong. We get a sense of in his past, he's corrected things he felt were wrong that maybe weren't, and it's gotten him in big trouble. But this sort of deep need draws him back out off that couch and back into this nasty world that he's been trying to stay apart from. And I also think those scenes of him with the workers, the first thing I think of when it comes to this movie is that forest that they're working in. And their job, it's a very interesting job. They've been hired essentially to poison the trees there by the landowners, because the landowners want to clear it, but they're not legally allowed to unless the trees are sick.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, kind of shady work they're involved in. But it's honest labor that the men put forth in this forest. And it's a beautifully lit forest that they work in. There's even an early scene. The first time we see him, it's pouring rain, but the sun is still working through. The guys here have this relationship with each other, especially at the lunch hour where they're hanging out, teasing each other, joking around. And when Gary, the Sheridan character, comes there, it's like he's found nirvana.
Right.
Because he's been traveling around with this family, not knowing where they're going to get their next meal, how they're going to make money. It's a very abusive situation. And he's found a place with someone who's going to be honest with him, pay him for hard work, and hanging out with people who are just enjoying each other's company. And it's set so much apart from the rest of this world. Joe's other routine is, you know, he makes these really fidgety visits to a nasty brothel where he doesn't really find any sort of comfort there, which is why you sense he's going. He has run-ins with the law that go wrong and threaten to throw him out of this routine. And so this forest was just such a beautiful spot, and it evoked this mood, this tension that Joe has the film overall between, you know, just this nastiness that we want to stay away from and this ideal that we want to find, and how it's not possible to just be in one world or necessarily the other. The movie, I think I'm similar with you. There are a few instances while watching it where I was kind of taken out of it structure-wise, or it was very literal for a David Gordon Green film. But as I left it, it kind of grew in my estimation, and I kept thinking about it more and more because of this pervasive mood that the movie did create.
Harry, why do you stick around like this? You're old enough, smart enough, do your own thing.
What's most important right now is me taking care of Dorothy and Mama. Because we kind of got a family problem right now.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film from director David Gordon Green. It stars Nicolas Cage and Ty Sheridan. It's called Joe. I'm with you completely on the way nature is shot here, in that contrast to a lot of the bleakness and the horror that we see in this world. And David Gordon Green has been compared to Terrence Malick quite a bit throughout his career, and I think you definitely see that in some of those nature scenes in particular. But I did mention, and you were kind of touching on it there a little bit as well, certain elements that were distracting or maybe disturbing a little bit about this film. And I've got a few of those, and I wonder how you react to some of them, how you saw this movie, because the one element that really jumped out to me was the sense, I think some have used the phrase with other films and other literature, Southern miserableism. And I certainly felt that, where it's one thing to get a lot of, as I said, the horror of this world, the just real abject poverty of it, scene after scene. But at some point, it starts to feel maybe a little bit like too much, where, okay, I'm going to get the shot of the mom smoking her cigarette in her underwear by whatever oven they have in the kitchen. I can't give this away. I don't want to spoil any plot elements, but I'm going to get not only the sister who's mute, who doesn't talk, but let's see what happens to her. Really? Could that be any worse? There is that sense where you're just getting it piled on. And I think David Gordon Green would argue he's trying to show something honest, but maybe you can be too honest. Maybe at some point those elements do start to feel a little bit forced.
The Southern miserableism, if that's what you want to call it, I didn't feel like that was piled on. I felt for the most part it was providing context. I don't know if you'd include this as part of that, but the adversary Joe encounters a couple of times in the film and drives the action, I found that to be a little bit forced.
Sure.
Not in the sense that it was piling on the misery of this milieu, but the character itself I did feel forced.
Okay.
The sister, I agree, I completely agree, is a problem, because the first time you learn that Gary has a sister, I don't know why, but I could just tell how that was going to be used.
Really?
And not only as a plot device, but in a really uncomfortable one. Uncomfortable in the fact that even if it reflects a reality that may be out there, it was not a necessary reality for what the movie wanted to do in the end. We didn't need it to get that harsh. Now, the Q&A that David Gordon Green did after the screening I was at, he actually spoke a little bit about how they softened that compared to the Larry Brown novel.
I believe
it. So this is, you know, something they did keep in mind, but I still think it stands apart from some of the other harshness that we see in terms of its necessity for the story.
Sure. And following that, one of my other issues is the fact that in the end, as much as I wanted to see a little bit of resolution and some closure, and I am going to dance around this again a little bit, I'm not trying to spoil anything about the end of this film, there is, as I learned from talking to David Gordon Green, an ending in the book. The original material is much harsher and doesn't end with that kind of resolution at all. But that's what I was expecting watching this movie, just based on how it's presented. And I didn't want it to give me that nice little light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
Even if it's a little bit faint, I wasn't sure that the movie had really set us up for that as an audience, again, feeling a little bit forced. Now, after wading through all of that misery, did I want that hope? Yes, absolutely I did. And look, it's not as if this is a quote-unquote happy ending by conventional Hollywood standards, but the movie is so bleak, so miserable at times, that to then get that at the end, again, that was something that stood out to me.
I'd actually argue now whether or not you feel this movie deserves any glimpse of hope at all is an open question. But I actually argue if they decided they wanted to do that, they really do it in a nicely structured way. They do set it up quite nicely, because this epilogue you're talking about, without giving any details, is a perfect mirror of the very opening scene.
Which I love.
And so I thought it did, even in the staging of the characters, the way it echoed that. And again, It's a miserable film in the sense of what's happening to these characters. So I'm with you in that a part of me wanted a little lightness at the end because we go through a lot. These characters go through a lot.
Yeah.
And it weighs on you. So maybe it was just that part of me that wanted a little bit of levity towards the end, but I thought they handled it really well. And this gives me a chance also to talk about what's possibly the best thing about the movie, because he features very prominently in that opening scene that I talked about, and it's Gary Poulter who plays Ty Sheridan's dad. And this is a non-professional, as we've mentioned. This is a case where I didn't realize that until well after the film,
right,
when David Gordon Green explained it mm-hmm. that way. And it shocked me, to be honest with
yeah.
you. It totally shocked me. I mean, sometimes you can pick up on it. And keep in mind, it shocked me knowing that David Gordon Green does this all the time. And I could point out that the workers in Cage's crew were non-professionals, not mm-hmm. in a distracting way, but you could just tell that's what yeah. they were going for there. Not for a second did I feel that Poulter might have been someone, as he is, that the cast and crew came upon and asked to audition and thought he could pull off the part. I mean, this guy is riveting, and I'll spoil it. I'll get into more detail about that when we talk about our top five performances by non-professional actors, because he's that good, I put him on my list.
Well, keeping that in mind, I want to discuss that performance a little bit, because you're right, I've given this a lot of thought, not only because of my response to the performance, which was a very strong one, like you, and as I said in my interview, which we played last week with David Gordon Green, I told him I thought for sure that Gary Poulter was some Juilliard-trained actor. I thought he had to be someone who was a professional, and I had just never seen him on screen before. And I know it's a great performance because of that response it provoked every time he was on screen. I think it also has to do, of course, with how the character was conceived. But that idea of thinking he was trained, it does reflect the difference in style and the method of the men in Joe's crew, as you mentioned, who are, for lack of a better word, more awkward on screen than Poulter is. But I'm still finding that I'm really wrestling with why I think it's such a good performance. And this is something I wrestle with throughout this week's entire top five. There's a lack of calculation to Poulter that lends itself to this notion of authenticity, but maybe it feels like more of a genuine performance because there appears to be some more calculation to it, more than those men out in the field. And so that line, finding that line between that calculation and authenticity, it's easy to say, well, it just feels so natural. Okay, but the men working feel natural as well, but it's a different kind of naturalness. And I found a quote from a writer named Andrew Ford in a book he wrote called The Sound of Pictures. And he said this: because non-professionals do less, their faces generally stiller than those of trained actors, we look harder. Because they tend to speak their lines with less artifice, we listen harder. And I was thinking about that because it seems very true. Just on its face seems true. But in relation to Poulter's performance, is he really doing less? Is he doing less than Cage? By doing more than Cage, and I think he might be actually, is he actually somewhat more natural? Because you can tell that Cage is playing subdued. Is he restrained in a sort of artificial, actorly way? So I don't know if that matches with what Ford is saying, but definitely we listen harder to him. And it's not just because he mumbles, which he does quite a bit. So again, it makes me ask, is there truly something about his acting, his delivery, his intonation, his inflection, whatever you want to call a performance, that is less artificial? Or is it, Josh, more that we don't have any prior relationship to him, whereas we certainly do with Cage? You talked about the idea of Nick Cage. We have no idea of Gary Poulter whatsoever, and so we completely buy in from the moment we see him.
You want it?
Yeah. I'm not doing my lesson. Life's lesson. You only learn about waving. Popping. You ever see popping? Pop. You know what locking is? I really can't do a whole lot of locking. Look, I'm standing and...
Well,
I don't see myself doing much of that in the near future there, sir.
For me, it's that he's somehow doing both. He has that natural physicality of the part because he's lived the part. So he doesn't have to try in that sense. He looks like this guy, he talks like this guy, and he moves like this guy. When we get to our top five, I'll mention a few times how physicality plays such a big role when you're using a non-professional actor, I think. Yet, he also has what you're talking about, which is usually comes from training, this thoughtfulness, this intent,
yes,
this real consideration of the material that's deeper than worrying about saying the right lines at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
You can still sense that sometimes,
right,
in non-professional actors. I never sensed that with him. And there's one scene which just sealed it for me. And I'm not sure if he's working with a non-professional actor in this scene, but I think he probably is. It's someone who's playing another homeless man that Wade, the Gary Poulter character, first meets downtown in this small Texas town. And he tries to strike up a conversation with him, largely because the guy's walking out of a liquor store with a bottle. Doesn't get much response. Follows him down the street, follows him down the tracks,
yeah,
into the woods where this guy is going to drink the wine that he has. And I won't say where that scene goes, but this was an actor in total control of that moment. And that's where, I didn't know he was a non-professional, but that's where all those things we sometimes attribute to non-professionals, where they're just being themselves, mm-hmm, is the phrase we use, goes out the window, and you're caught in the drama of that scene because of how it's filmed and how it's staged and how the script writing goes as well, but also because of the way Poulter draws out the suspense.
I think in addition to the physicality, and this is something we'll get to in the top five, for me, what really stands out with Poulter in particular, but I think non-professionals who do a good job as well, is he's a very good listener. And that's where that calculation comes in. You talk about them being somewhat intent, that they seem focused, that they are engaged in a scene. It's because they're very good listeners. And we do see that from Poulter without a doubt. But that scene you brought up, I don't want to get into it anymore, except to say that it's a really horrifying scene, masterfully shot and set up,
yes,
and acted. Nevertheless, it was a scene where that character took a turn and did something so reprehensibly wrong that even though we had seen him up to that point do a lot of things wrong, and he was not a good father, not a good husband, really not a good worker, not a good person, he does something that the movie sort of treats as if it's part of everyday life for him. And maybe that's what makes it so horrifying, but also makes that character evil in a way that I hadn't seen coming at all.
Yeah, the movie, I didn't see the particulars coming, but I'll tell you, when I first saw him look at that guy starting to walk down the street,
yeah,
it was a possibility in my mind that something like what happens was going to happen. And I agree also that this elevates the movie in a way to sort of a mythical realm, in a sense, where all of a sudden we do feel like we're dealing with an evil entity in many ways that's taken the shape of this actual father. And then the question becomes about the title character, Joe, and where does he fit in this? Because here is someone we've already learned is a little bit of both. He has tendencies of all kinds inside him. And when he encounters this and also sees this boy who's, you know, not wholly good, but he's held up as someone who is not yet fully formed.
Yeah.
Having yet had to make that choice of what sort of person is he going to be, that's where all the drama for the movie lies. And that's the thing that sort of lasted in my mind, even if the movie itself, I felt, was maybe not quite as overpowering as I was watching it.
Yeah, those moments and that ultimate effect, the mood, as you touched on, is what really does carry this film. Even as you said, I think this is probably what you were referring to when you talked about it at times being too literal. There is a lack of subtlety with its symbolism and its metaphors that surprised me a little bit from David Gordon Green.
And that late night soliloquy from Cage. I mean, I can't believe that was in a Green film.
When you're watching a film and you have them explain to you that what they're doing is poisoning trees, you don't have to be an English major to think about what they're doing for a living. And you talked about this a little bit, that they're out in nature and they're destroying
it. Yeah, that's all right there for you.
They're these healthy things, these trees, and they're sort of like these men who are big and strong, and yet they're poisoned on the inside, of course. And then we're going to get that juxtaposed with the planting of trees and the sense of rebirth. That's all definitely very on the nose. But also, when I interviewed Gordon Green, I asked him about this sense of catharsis with the violence. And we haven't even touched on really the bravura sequence of this movie, is this crazy sequence where Cage goes back to that brothel and brings his dog with him.
Yeah.
And you want to talk about juxtapositions. How about the scene of Cage being with a prostitute upstairs while his dog is downstairs wreaking violence and having his way with this other dog? And you just really need to see it. I'd love to break it down at some point, but you talk about masculinity and the kind of horrifying nature of it in this world. It's all right there. And it's not subtle, but again, again, there's something that I really did respond to about it. But as much as I was waiting for that violence to finally unravel and unleash itself, because this character has been so repressed and holding it in the whole time, by the end of the film, when you get a sense of closure after violence, it makes me wonder if David Gordon Green is having his cake and eating it too. Is he having it both ways? And that the whole movie seems to be this critique of this type of masculinity and the way violence and revenge is a vicious cycle. And yet, at the same time, the movie relies on that the way so many films do to give us that quote-unquote satisfying conclusion.
I would say decidedly not, but unfortunately, without getting into spoilers, I can't. And it lies in, there's a final confrontation,
yes,
let's say, where Gary is there, Joe is there, and Wade, the father, they're all there. The particulars of how that concludes and who initiates the final act,
I thought you might go
made
there, yeah,
all the difference,
okay,
for me.
Okay.
Really did.
Joe is out now here in Chicago and in select cities around the country. It's also available via cable on demand.
When we get back, the Film Spotting poll proposes an indie director deathmatch.
More violence.
That's right.
From us men here on Film Spotting.
The winner not only gets to live, he gets a $20 million budget for his next project.
There you go.
Plus, we'll give some attention to the documentary and animation genres with a few quick recommendations of recent releases. Stay with us. Brief interruption here, folks, to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM.
We're also brought to you by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. Josh, I thought that these little promo segments would be correction-free zones. Maybe we could avoid making mistakes.
I don't think we have correction-free zones.
We apparently do not, as we'll learn here in a second. Shutterstock.com, of course, offers a million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. Whether you're working on your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or other type of film project, they also have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most come in HD and now 4K. So, Josh, I was looking ahead to this segment. I went to Shutterstock, did a video search. I was thinking about the movie Joe and Americana.
Okay.
Okay. Fair enough, right? If you've seen the movie, it makes sense. Typed in Americana, 750 video results, ranging from Mount Rushmore to American flags to motorcycles. And the most American of all, avocados.
No apple pie.
No avocados. Apple pie. Maybe apple pie. I don't want to make another mistake.
Oh,
I think there probably, yes, are a few apple pies in there. But getting to that mistake, remember on last week's show, we were talking about Under the Skin. And I said, if you look for skin, you look for aliens, you find all sorts of stuff. You look for ScarJo, nothing comes up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Hank Schiffman from Mountain View, California wrote in and said, Adam, I just had to respond to your comment. Wrote in and said, as a Shutterstock supplier, but only for photographs, I had trouble believing that there were no images of Scarlett Johansson on Shutterstock. And in fact, I found 42 video clips and 878 photos of Ms. Johansson on the site.
Aha.
The few I checked were all editorial. I suspect that getting her to sign a model release for commercial use would be way beyond the budget of most stock footage and photo suppliers. Personally, I limit myself to subjects who are marginally less famous, but rather more affordable. Again, that's Hank Schiffman. He is one of those very photographers photographers and filmmakers out there who give their footage and their pictures to Shutterstock.com. And I guess I don't know what I did wrong with that search interface.
Sounds like you just weren't using the filters appropriately.
Usually it is user error, and that definitely applies to me. Shutterstock adds 12,000 video clips each week. So every time you visit, you'll find something new. Maybe, in fact, I didn't make a mistake at all. They just added all those pictures and videos of Scarlett Johansson.
Probably that's what happened.
In the interim, after I said that on last week's show.
You could try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card is needed. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Save your video selections that you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM414 and new accounts will receive 20% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 20% off new accounts, use offer code FILM414. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
His ghost lives in the trailer.
What is that?
O negative. That's delicious.
Blood on a stick.
On a stick.
That's not bad.
Very refreshing, especially when you're in a hot spot. Checkmate, my darling.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That was Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston as a pair of centuries-old vampires enjoying some refreshing blood popsicles. I prefer O negative, Josh. In director Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive, we are hoping to review Lovers on next week's show. And our poll question this week concerns Jarmusch. We've got him in a death match against one of his 80s era indie director peers. That isn't a bit. But first, the results of the poll question we posed a couple weeks back.
With Scarlett Johansson even more inescapable than normal recently, appearing in both the new Captain America sequel as Black Widow and in Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin, we wanted to see how you, our enlightened, judicious listeners, rated Johansson as an actress. Unfortunately, though, all we learned is that we asked an incredibly badly worded poll question, apparently. Here's our very unfortunate phrasing.
You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with how this question is phrased whatsoever. Apparently, our options just weren't good enough, weren't sufficient.
It didn't initially strike me as problematic, but
well,
here's what we did offer. Scarlett Johansson is my favorite actress, one of the best of her generation, meaning under 30, fine in the right role, or she's got looks but no chops.
Here's how it came out. In last place, decidedly, my favorite actress, 1%, a whopping 8 votes.
Wow.
8 people out there, though, think Scarlett Johansson is the best actress alive.
That's probably about what I would have guessed, yeah.
I want to hear from those 8 people. Send us an email. Tell us why ScarJo is your favorite. In second to last place, she's got looks but no chops with 9%. 18%, one of the best of her generation, under 30, and finally the winner, fine in the right role, 72%. So not exactly a glowing recommendation there for Scarlett Johansson, but of the options, you could do worse, certainly. I believe, if memory serves correct, that you and Michael Phillips shared this poll question a few weeks ago, and both were in that 72%. Is that right?
We were, and I guess it is kind of a broad option, which is maybe why it took it that hugely. I think that's a little bit what Brian Finch is getting to here when he wrote in to say, this is a good question, but with terrible choices, there should be the following option. Very good actress who is sometimes miscast.
So not putting the blame on Scarlett Johansson for the role she picks or her performance in those roles, you're blaming the industry.
I think he's onto something okay here, though, because I've said before, she's misused. And I think being miscast is part of that. Sure, she could say no. That's part of it, too.
Jacob Anderson says, Brian is absolutely right. This directed at our fine producer, Sam, who came up with this question. Next time you need to consult him before you formulate a poll question. Jacob, we will add you to the payroll or the list of interns that inevitably gets fired. Brittany Miller said, yes, Sam, you should listen to Brian.
Wow. So,
there we go.
For Brian.
There is. But we did get Max O'Connell in Syracuse, New York, who not only managed to tell us his location, which we really appreciate in these poll comments, but he suppressed his own urge to criticize the question. He said this.
I went with fine in the right role, though I think that understates it a bit. She can be phenomenal in the right role, as proved by Ghost World, where we believed in a gradually dying friendship, in part because she's a perfect counterbalance of growing maturity to Thora Birch's Enid. Her, which doesn't work unless you have an appropriately lively and warm presence in the role, and now Under the Skin, in what's one of the gutsiest performances from a major movie star in some time. We have a tendency to underrate modern movie stars, who perhaps don't have a range as wide as Kate Blanchett or Kate Winslet, but Johansson has more than proved herself to be a good actress. It's just that now she's not being badly miscast like she was in stuff like The Black Dahlia.
Well, everyone was used wrongly in The Black Dahlia, so I'm not sure that makes any sense or matters here in the grand scheme of things, but Bruce closes us out. He says she's great when she's not being asked to be a bombshell or a pinup girl, where she is given the latitude to just be a real person rather than being an icon. Lost in Translation was an excellent example of that, whereas something like The Island, not so much. So I'll give my pick this way. Definitely I'm with you guys. I'm with the 72%, the majority fine in the right role. But, and I do think this is indicative of how good she has been lately. It definitely is. If you'd asked me this poll question a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, I might have said fine in the right role, but I would have been a lot closer to picking she's got looks but no chops.
That's the way you talked about her up
right,
until the
and
last
year. I wouldn't
year.
Have even considered one of the best of her generation.
What
and
about my
here,
favorite actress?
Okay, so that's not happening. Now I endorse her completely for fine in the right role, and a couple more roles like what I've seen from her recently, a couple more performances like that, she belongs in that conversation. She
okay.
belongs in the conversation of the best 5 or 10 actresses of her age.
Well,
if
never
we keep
mind an Oscar, Scarlett Johansson, you might finally win Adam Kempinar over. There's your goal.
The ABK seal of approval might be coming her way. We will see if she is that lucky. Thanks to everyone who voted and those who voted in the poll and didn't chastise us along the way. That brings us to this week's poll question. It's one of our patented film spotting death matches. And this is one, Josh, as you know, I always pat myself on the back for how well I can read our audience. I can predict these poll questions usually, sometimes down to the percentage. This one, I truly don't know. I've got a little bit of a guess, but I could be completely surprised. So the death match is between a pair of writer-directors who helped create and define the model of the 80s and 90s era independent filmmaker. They've both frequently worked with big-name actors, but they have both retain creative control of their projects and largely worked outside of the studio system. So in one corner, Josh, we have Jim Jarmusch.
So that'll include 1980's Permanent Vacation, which was his debut, along with Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, Mystery Train, Night on Earth, Dead Man, that was with Johnny Depp, Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai, and Broken Flowers with Bill Murray. Jarmusch, he's never been Oscar nominated, but he is a frequent nominee and a 3-time winner at the Cannes Film Festival. His previous film was Limits of Control. I didn't catch it. It was perhaps the least well-received of any in his career. And then we do have this year's film, Only Lovers Left Alive, with Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston as vampires.
Jarmusch is going against, in the other corner, John Sayles, who made his debut with 1979's The Return of the Secaucus 7. Between 87 and 96, he made Mate One, 8 Men Out, Passion Fish, The Secret of Rowan Inish, and Lone Star. He's been nominated for a Best Screenplay Oscar twice, Passion Fish in 92, Lone Star in 96. But it has been a while since Sayles has made what you would consider a must-see film, or I think what most would consider a must-see film. Maybe you have to go back as far as 2002 and Sunshine State, or even before that in 1999 and his movie Limbo. His most recent film is Go for Sisters, which it's listed as a 2013 film, but I want to say it just played in some places this year. I could be wrong.
I don't even remember it existing, which I think speaks to where maybe they've been at it recent years. Can I make a prediction? I clearly don't know the film spotting
Please
audience
do.
As well, but I'm not quite as intimidated by where this might go. I have a feeling it's going to be Jarmusch.
I do too.
I mean, for me, it's a little bit having to do with, well, a couple things. Some of his movies have become cult films that have lasted well beyond the initial splash they've made. I don't know that you can say that of any of Sayles, maybe, actually. But when you think of something like Ghost Dog, which has its following, Dead Man has its following, these movies live on in that way. And I also feel like for people who are, want to start really digging more deeply into film and learning about some of the major figures in the past, which we hear from listeners quite a bit who fit into that category, I think you'd start with Jarmusch before you go to Sayles if you're doing that.
Well, that's a good point. It gets back to kind of that BuzzFeed list we discussed in bonus content last week. And if you're talking about canon and those kind of questions, for a budding cinephile, who's more essential, Jarmusch or Sayles? It's probably Jarmusch. And that's why I do think he's going to win this poll question as well. I just think he may not win it by quite as wide a margin as some might predict. I could be completely wrong, but I wonder if there's a lot of listeners out there like me who are going to vote for John Sayles. Because as much as we love some of those Jarmusch films, and I do love many of them, for me, there's just something so essential about films like Matewan. And I love Eight Men Out as well, but even better than that, Lone Star. These are movies for me, definitely Lone Star, maybe Matewan, Passion Fish I love as well, that are in that top 50 discussion for me. And there's not a Jarmusch film that comes that close.
I'm probably the opposite.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
We want to know what you think.
So I'll be voting Jarmusch.
Settle this death match. Who walks out of the cage alive? You can vote now at filmspotting.net. And speaking of great directors, the bonus content we're going to feature this week is some of your feedback to our top five from last week's show, our Desert Island Directors. Basically, if we're stuck on an island for eternity and somehow we've got a Blu-ray system.
Was it eternity?
I think it's eternity.
I thought we didn't know how long.
Okay.
Now I have to redo my list.
I'm
if it's eternity.
Eternity.
Great.
Well, you can do that list later. We'll do the Desert Island Directors for Eternity list and see if it changes.
Show 846.
When we're running out of ideas, I'm with you. That bonus content is available on the Film Spotting app for iPhone, Android, or Windows 8 phones. You can go to filmspotting.net and click on apps right there at the top of the page for more information. We did get some good responses. I kind of wanted to hold off, actually, Josh, to give people more time to listen to the show and respond, because I know we're going to get some good feedback. But what we have is very good as well. So, again, if you want to hear that's this week's Film Spotting bonus content.
Our guests today in the studio are The National.
We're about to talk to a band called The National.
This is one of the most talked about bands on the planet.
The new record is blowing up. Number 3 on the charts. You were recently the subject of a 10-page spread in the New York Times. The Times piece mentions you guys are a band of brothers, but then there's you, Matt. You're the guy in the band who doesn't have a brother.
I do have a brother. He's more of a metalhead. He thinks indie rock's pretentious bullshit.
From the trailer to the new doc, Mistaken for Strangers, that's Matt Berninger, the lead singer of the band The National, talking about his brother, Tom Berninger, who's also the film's director. This was intended as a backstage look at a popular indie rock band on its ascent. This becomes much more about its maker and his relationship with his famous sibling. Adam, we wanted to take a few minutes to talk about some films one or the other of us has seen. We'll get to my thoughts on the Oscar-nominated animated film Ernest and Celestine in a bit, but let's start with Mistaken for Strangers. On your Letterboxd post, you called it a rock doc masterpiece, and you're something of a connoisseur of rock documentaries, so that's saying something. You also suggested that this is an early frontrunner for our Golden Brick Award, so care to elaborate on that high praise?
Not really.
That's all you need to say?
Well, because whether it ends up being a Golden Brick nominee or not, I'm not trying to be coy, but I've got a feeling this movie is going to come up, at least for me, a few more times throughout the year, so I'm going to be somewhat brief in my thoughts on this movie, but as I described it on Letterboxd, imagine that somehow Scotty J, the Philip Seymour Hoffman character from Boogie Nights, was merged together with Mark Borchert, the character, the real life character from the documentary American Movie.
I'm already picturing great hair.
Yes, absolutely. And somehow they became one being, and that being made a rock documentary.
Okay.
Mistaken for Strangers would be the result. And if that doesn't sell you already, I don't know what else I can say. I do figure that many people listening to us right now won't be inclined to seek this movie out because of either their apathy towards The National or their antipathy towards The National, either no opinion whatsoever, or they view them as one of those bands they despised and they just really don't have any interest in watching a movie about them, even if it is only 74 minutes long, which this movie is. I fall more into the former category. I'm just not that familiar with them, only heard a few of their songs. But as you noted, I do really like music documentaries and concert or road tour documentaries, and the best of them, like the Dylan documentary from D.A. Pennebaker, Don't Look Back, reveal something about the band or its members, its music, while also exploring something more universal and compelling. Whether in that movie about the nature of celebrity or fame, in this case, it's this very one-sided sibling rivalry between Tom and Matt, and Tom's quest to express himself and not just assert his presence, but his existence through this artistic endeavor. And that pursuit is what really elevates this documentary from just another road music doc. It's a must-see as far as I'm concerned. It's playing in select cities. It's available via iTunes and other streaming platforms, also via cable on demand.
So clearly more than a fan documentary, although
it
might serve that way
I
for
think
fans
it will,
of the band.
Because as I said, I don't know that you're going to get probably a better portrait of what each member of this band is after, but we get at that by viewing it through the lens of this person, Tom, and specifically through his relationship with Matt. That's the funnel, and that funnel is very illuminating in this case. Another movie I wanted to quickly recommend that's playing in select cities and can also be seen via cable on demand is Finding Vivian Maier, another documentary. And I wanted Josh to spotlight these two movies anyway, since they were just released, but it's really appropriate for this show completely randomly, where we're highlighting non-professional performances. Because, of course, in Mistaken for Strangers, Tom Berninger is a first-time director and really a non-professional filmmaker who nevertheless makes a great movie. And Finding Vivian Maier is about a non-professional photographer. She shoots on Chicago streets, or did shoot on Chicago streets and suburbs, and her work is discovered after her death, and rightfully, I think most people will agree from watching the movie, hailed as brilliant. And like Mistaken for Strangers, it's also a case of the filmmaker inserting himself into his movie. This is a film co-directed by John Maloof and Charlie Siskel, and Maloof is the guy who discovered Vivian Maier's work, and really through social media and through web postings and blog postings, made her this figure that everyone was trying to learn more about. And his curiosity into her life is what drives the movie. And there's been some discussion surrounding the movie about this all being an invasion of her privacy and the ethics of that, because she was a very private person. And there's this debate about whether or not she would even want people to see her work, and also the fact that Maloof is profiting, it seems, fairly handsomely from this. I mean, he's really gotten a whole career out of this endeavor. I think that's all really fascinating stuff to discuss, and is a separate topic in some way from the question of the quality of the movie. But where it does matter in terms of how you receive the movie is whether you think that Maloof as a director explores this conflict enough, or just sort of raises it and then glosses over it. I'm on the fence about that still, honestly. I have feelings both ways. And I think mainly because I know I'm really happy her work saw the light of day. And if I was in his shoes, I know I'd be rationalizing ways to get her work out there. And if not profit from it, get some acclaim from it. I don't think you could help yourself because, though, largely, and this is where I come down on his side, I just think he's that naturally drawn to the work.
Appreciative of the work.
And appreciative. Yeah. I think that really is the key. And if you question that, then you may have a different reaction to the movie. But I got that sense. And if anything else, just seeing that work is really what makes this movie worthwhile. So another way it's in contrast to Mistaken for Strangers, that's a movie where almost the less music you see, the better the movie is. And that isn't a knock on The National. It's just because what's really interesting about the movie isn't what's happening on stage most of the time. And this is a movie where I actually think the more we get to see the art and people talking about the art, the better it is.
I wonder how the question of why does haunt the movie. I mean, of why she didn't allow this to be put out there sometime before. It could haunt it in a good way, I imagine, where it's something that's just left out there to kind of keep you enticed and add to the mystery. Or it could be something that you feel should have been pursued with interviews. And I don't know how it handles that.
It's touched on. Okay. It's touched on. But again, that's where maybe, is it enough? Is it sufficient?
Yeah.
Should he have spent more time on it? Or is the time he gives it just enough because he is more focused on the work and the story of her as a person? Those are all questions, again, I think, that make this movie worth seeing.
Well, the one I caught up with recently was Ernest and Celestine. And though this was nominated for an Academy Award in the Best Animated Feature category, it's just now getting released. I think it was in 40 theaters last week, and it's expanding to another 20 or so on April 18. I caught it at the Music Box Theater. The kids were on their spring break, so we were just bumming around the city, doing things, hitting some museums, and happened to catch that at the end of the week. And it was a delight. It was just so nice. I mean, I didn't realize how much this CGI animation that we live with now has become to feel heavy on me, even though I like a lot of it. But there's something sort of harsh and weighty when you go into one of those crisp, popping colors movies that we get, even though probably my favorite movie of the year so far, the Lego movie, is full of that stuff. It can work for sure. But this has an aesthetic. It's based, I should say, on the children's books of Gabriel Vincent. So I'm sure it draws its aesthetic from those. And their pencil sketches, watercolors, and there's just breathing space in the film that is so lovely. It's a very simple story. Envisions a world where above the street, the bears are in charge. So they have like a bear courthouse, bear bakery, all that stuff. And in the sewers underneath, the mice have a mirror society where they're in charge. They don't mix, because bears eat mice. I don't know if bears really eat mice. It's a question we're debating in our house right now. But in this film, they do, and that's a problem, except for one mouse, Celestine, who doesn't believe this and attempts to befriend a bear, Ernest. Gets a little heavy-handed in the we can all be friends messaging, especially at the end, which actually gets sort of harsh a little bit too, which is surprising.
Does the bear finally eat the mouse?
I'm not going to tell you that. I'm not going to spoil it for you, Adam.
Come on.
But there are some lovely interludes, especially in between, where they do get to know each other. There's a nice conceit where Ernest the bear is in one bear band, really. So he's all these instruments in his house, and Celestine draws. And at one point, she begins drawing Spring. They're imagining Spring, and his music begins to accompany her drawings, and this sort of takes over the screen, and it's this really impressionistic part of the film that it just works wonders. So if for nothing else, for just a break from the films that rely on this heavy CGI, even when they rely on it in a way that works, this is a breath of fresh air.
Again, Mistaken for Strangers and Finding Vivian Maier out and available to be seen in various platforms. I think Ernest and Celestine, that's not the case, probably only in
I think it's
some
only
theaters.
Theatrical, right?
Yeah, it was playing here at the Music Box in Chicago.
All right, from a non-professional photographer to non-professional actors, the Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Best performances by movie novices. Stay with us.
The sounds there of Atlanta, Georgia's Black Lips. You heard the tunes Boys in the Wood and Dandelion Dust from the new album Underneath the Rainbow. They're currently on tour in Boston, Montreal, and Toronto this weekend before playing a sold-out show here in Chicago at Logan Square Auditorium on the 26th of the month. More information at black-lips.com. We get to our donations now, Josh. A few donors. We want to thank people who were so generous as to head over to filmspotting.net or PayPal and throw in some hard-earned dollars in support of the show. We start with a brand new $10 a month subscriber to Film Spotting.
That would be Jason from Palmerston, Northern Territory, Australia.
Also got a donation from Victoria in Long Island City, New York, Robert in Sandy, Utah, and Sam right here in Chicago.
This is a very belated donation in honor of my friend Emily in Minnesota, whose birthday was in February. I'm really behind. We are both devoted listeners, so I thought a donation would be a great way to celebrate her birthday and our friendship. Thank you, Film Spotting, for giving us yet another thing in common and something to talk about almost every week.
You know, I really can't think, Josh, of a better way to celebrate someone's birthday and friendship than a donation to Film Spotting.
That's all I would ever want.
Right. And that's all I'm going to give you. I promise I'm donating to the show every week. Thank you to Sam, Robert, Victoria, Jason, and to Emily in Minnesota for listening and being Sam's friend. Very thoughtful of Sam there to send in that note. We hope you only have positive things to say about the show. We also want to thank all of our regular monthly donors, whether it's $2, $5, or $10 a month. It really does keep us doing what we're doing. Also, a quick plug, as we usually do here, for Jeff Goldsmith, his podcast, The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, where you can hear his interviews with screenwriters on the podcast. It's available in iTunes, and you can also get his Backstory magazine app, which is available on iPad. More information there at backstory.net.
Sound Opinions at the Movies has a film for all of you who know what it is to be a fan.
Truly love some silly little piece of music or some band so much that it hurts.
Join Greg and me and other music fans for a Goose Island beer and a screening of the movie Almost Famous at the Music Box Theater on Wednesday, April 23rd. Get tickets at a discount at soundopinions.org.
Hi, this is Lynn Shelton, director of Hump Day and Your Sister Sister. You are listening to Film Spotting.
You've never.
Eiffel Tower, the Empire State.
My pearls was as high on my very first day.
Your grandson's hand as he plays with your head.
To be honest, I really don't care.
You're listening to Film Spotting, a duet there from the unlikely pair of Peter Stormare and Bjork from Lars von Trier's Dancer in the Dark.
Can't wait for their debut album.
We're all waiting patiently. It's top five time here on Film Spotting. This week, we're talking about performances by non-professionals or non-actors, a list that will not include Bjork, no matter how much we may or may not like that performance, because we're not going to count any performance by a singer or a musician. That's actually a list we've already tackled here on Film Spotting way back in 2007. It was our top five musicians turned actors. We're also not including debut performances by child actors. That also seems like a completely separate list. Not necessarily a case where someone plucked an actor out of complete obscurity. These might be people who had acted in some capacity before as young kids or saw themselves at age 12 as being an actor. It just seems like a little bit of a distinction from some of the picks that I think are going to inhabit our list. Did you have any other rules, Josh?
Well, we were going to name this the Bresson Memorial List, right? So
we
stayed away from any performances in any Bresson films.
Right.
I don't know if you
made
have
it tough.
Just one that came.
No.
The one that probably would have made my list was Nadine Nordier
from Mouchette.
Yeah. I think, you know, that maybe wasn't one of my favorite Bresson films from the marathon we did, but she was just devastating.
Martin LaSalle in Pickpocket, Francois Leterrier from A Man Escaped. I might have gone that route.
Yeah,
so yes, he had
too.
Some films that definitely had professional actors, but this was a world that Bresson gave us that often featured non-professional actors. So we are calling it the Robert Bresson Memorial List. None of those are eligible. Josh, your number five.
My number five is Gina Carano from Haywire. This was Steven Soderbergh's 2012 action experiment with the former mixed martial arts fighter Carano as a wrongfully accused espionage agent who goes on the run. Obviously, chances are she was mostly cast for her physicality, for her athleticism here, and that certainly pays off. Carano moves swiftly in this film with a clear purpose, someone who's obviously used to moving swiftly with a clear purpose and intent. I love how she saves all of her energy for the brutal fight scenes that frequently erupt.
Play like you're shocked. The guy with the broken arm, Aaron. Get in his head. Keep bringing up Barcelona. Get him arguing with Kenneth.
Kenneth.
My fault. I should have seen that one coming. You did.
In a way, you can also even say that her flat line delivery, which is there.
I was just going to say.
We talked about in
our review. I love that you wrote off her sleepy line deliveries as saving her energy.
That's exactly it. When watching clips again, too, I see that. I don't know if it was intended by her.
I'm just resting.
I don't know if it was intended. But it works for the character because someone like this, they're not going to expend one iota of energy that they don't have to. Talking to Michael Douglas, yeah. Well, you don't have to put too much into that. Save it for the fight scenes. Carano has such an efficiency and confidence that Haywire, even though it is begging to be read as this female empowerment parable, right? It almost feels like it's past those concerns. It implies we should be too, which is what I really liked about it. You never really think that Carano's adventure is some sort of bid for equality. It's just clear from her first takedown that she's superior. So Gina Carano, my number five.
Yeah, I'm with you on a lot of that. But as you noted, I wasn't a big fan of that performance, even though I did like the movie overall. But even if I did like Carano's performance, wouldn't have been eligible for me because I just decided to make this even harder on myself. Not only did I exclude musicians, I wrote off any entertainer of any kind whatsoever. And that even includes athletes. That includes anyone who the audience, some portion of the audience, could have had some kind of prior relationship with and had expectations that they brought to the screen.
Are you saying mixed martial arts is faked, Adam?
I am not.
I hope not.
I'm not. I'm not at all. But I am saying it is a performance of some kind in front of an audience. It's definitely a performance in front of an audience. And anyone who watches her performances in the ring would bring something to the table when they see her in a movie. So I just wanted to try and avoid that. And yes, to our friend Matt Singer from Film Spotting SVU, that means, alas, my number one is not going to be Kurt Thomas from Gymkata. I'm really sorry, but
otherwise,
he was a gymnast.
Otherwise, it would have been.
Otherwise, easily my number one. And, you know, we touched on the fact that we're not going with kids, but so many of these non-professional performances that really do stand out are performed by children. Mm-hmm. We talk about your go-to pick, Quvenzhané Wallace from Beasts of the Southern Wild. And so I love the fact that we're excluding children, because surely that means we won't hear that film's title at all on this list.
Yeah, there's a chance.
Okay. Thomas Turgoose from This Is England. One of my favorite movies, a discovery from our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon, The Mirror. Mina Mohammad Khani. You've got Gabe Nevins from Gus Van Sant's Paranoid Park, and you can go on and on. So a lot of those were really hard to leave off. And another little rule I put in place for myself is leaving off people who are playing themselves, because that too kind of seemed like a separate list that I could see us doing at some point. And Sean from the Film Spotting Advisory Board, who helps us out with these lists from time to time and comes up with ideas, when he threw out his favorite performances for this top five, he threw in Nanook of the North. And it's like Sean to be a little bit sarcastic and jokey and make an unconventional pick like that. But the more I thought about it, I realized you could, of course, argue that even though it's a documentary, that knowing what we know about how Flaherty shot that film, mm-hmm. that Nanook was playing a role. And so maybe he wasn't as much playing himself. Nevertheless, Nanook and some others like him will not be making my list. That all said, Josh, I did find a way to finagle my way around that exemption. For my number five pick, it is Merhadi Tayebi from A Moment of Innocence, a film that was part of our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon. And he is kind of playing himself. You could argue that certainly in this movie. It's not a documentary, though it has some quasi-documentary elements. But he is playing a character. In this case, he's playing someone known as the policeman. As it turns out, he happened to be this policeman at one point in his life, but it is clearly a version of himself. And it's also a case where the movie knows that it's recreating events. It's not a film that is trying to take something that happened in real life and give it to us as if this is how it happened. The movie, in a very meta way, is showing us how aware it is of what it's depicting. The movie is a semi-autobiographical account of the director Mohsen Makhmalbaf's experience as a teen. He was 17 years old, and he was at a protest rally, and he stabbed a policeman. And then here he is 2 decades later. He tracks down that policeman, who is Merhadi Tayebi, and they dramatize that event. And I think what stood out for me most with this character is really all-encompassed in a scene that I talked about during our review of that film, where he learns something through the performance, through that dramatization of an event that really becomes emotional. And it really becomes that way because, like a lot of these performers on our list, because he doesn't act those emotions at all. He lets the scene completely play out and makes a discovery that feels to us as if he just might be discovering this for the first time in his life. And it has to do with this sense of himself that he thought his whole life had been derailed by this accident. He thought that he was going to have something grand happen to him. I don't want to spoil too much for people who haven't seen it, because it really is something you need to see. It's a fantastic movie. But he goes back and in this recreation that the director sets up, learns that, you know what, maybe he's been wrong all these years. For 2 decades, he's harbored this sense of what his life could be and this sense of regret. And it turns out he was probably wrong. And the way you see that dawn on him, that recognition in Tayebi's performance, is really magical. It justifies the entire film for me and the entire meta nature of the movie. The experiment all pays off in that moment. So he's my number five.
Yeah, that's a good pick. And I think it points out something that we need to keep in mind when we're evaluating these sorts of performances, is not to hold them up to the traditional standards of judgment that we might have for another performance. Because what you're talking about, what other circumstances are there going to be where you can recreate that or judge a performance by that?
I mean,
we can't always say this is what you need to do in order to be professional. It's more what these people particularly brought to the role, I think. All right. Yes, I'm bringing up Beasts of the Southern Wild, though I should mention, that when we listed our top five performances of 2012 so far in July of that year, Adam, mm-hmm. you're the one who had Quvenzhané Wallace on your list.
True, but not your number four.
I did not.
That's true.
I had my number four, Dwight Henry, who plays the father to Quvenzhané Wallace's character, Hush Puppy, in that film. I, of course, did appreciate Wallace. She's the movie's heart and probably would be on this list if we allowed kids. But the reason I had Henry, who plays Wink, is because I think what some people have criticized about his performance actually plays right into what the movie needs. And that's this sense of straining that he does bring to the role. I'll completely admit that, especially when scenes get heightened emotionally. His character is a father who is in a very dire situation trying to provide for this daughter all by himself. And he doesn't think he's good enough to do it. He doesn't think he's capable enough to do it. So there's an authentic fumbling and an authentic desperation to the performance that works for me. It works for the role. And I also don't think that Henry gets credit for the quieter moments, because the clips we often hear and see, especially on something like Oscar night or other award shows, are the bigger ones, of course, right? That's how it always works. But there's some really nice, quiet moments in this film between him and Wallace when his character is trying his absolute best to live up to this responsibility in the only way he knows how. I think of a scene where he's trying to teach her how to fish.
Hold him down. You hold him down like this, and you whack him good with your fist. Go ahead, whack him. You whack him good. Hold him like that, and whack him. Hold him.
Ow!
You okay? That's all a part of it. Come on, you want to try it again? Come on, one more time.
What's really touching about that scene is it's also one of the moments where he realizes, because he's ailing, that he may not even be around that long. So if he thinks he's doing a bad job now, what's going to happen when he's gone? And I think you can feel that weight in Henry's performance.
It seems that that buzzer, you remember, I had put in every time you said the word hush puppy and it gave you that little shock.
Is it malfunctioning?
The other side of the board, it seems it's been taken out.
Or I'm immune.
I got to take that up with Golden Joe. Or you're right.
Increase the voltage,
Adam. Somehow. You can just handle it now. But speaking of Oscar night, we'll go to my number four pick, and it's Barkhad Abdi from Captain Phillips, just from this past year. And I mentioned the Oscars because it turns out, unless my facts are wrong here, that he's one of only three non-professional actors to ever earn an Oscar nomination. He did get that Best Supporting Actor nomination last year. He plays Musay, one of the Somali pirates, kind of the leader of this gang of Somali pirates who does take over the ship of Captain Phillips, of course, played by Tom Hanks. And Paul Greengrass, in making the decision to cast Abdi and other Somali non-professionals, said that he didn't want any of the pirates to be intimidated by Hanks, which you would think, in their discomfort or general lack of familiarity with what they're doing, and they have to know at some point that he's a big movie star compared to them, that they might feel a little bit of that intimidation. But I get it, because you do have to think that professional actors might be less inclined to stand up to an actor as venerated as Tom Hanks and really stand up to him in a scene. And he's actually playing, Hanks is a role very similar to Nicolas Cage in the movie that inspired this week's top five, Joe. He's a man of order. He's a man of control. He's the captain of this ship. And his behavior never really surprises us. It's not intended to. He kind of acts the way we would always expect him to act, and you need a foil to that. And Abdi's performance is a foil to that, with those wide eyes and his sometimes herky-jerky movements. In that famous scene where he says, "I'm the captain now," he's kind of swaying from side to side. It makes him seem unpredictable. And that unpredictability against Hanks's predictability makes him very, very dangerous. I also wonder, Josh, as well, if being a non-professional actor makes him somebody who's a little bit more willing to emphasize something that other actors may not want to, and that is fear. I think you really see that in the character of Musay. He's not incompetent. He's not someone that Captain Phillips should take lightly, but he is someone who is clearly out of his league. And that fear that you see in his eyes also informs that sense of danger, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I did consider him for this list. If anything held me back from putting him on, though, it's probably the opposite of what I experienced with Henry, where some of those same things you're talking about that on some level work for the role, his hesitancy in some ways, or the sense that Hanks and he are feeling each other out because they really have no concept of the other. Mm-hmm. It works for the characters, yet I sensed a little bit of it being of him as an actor as well. Some scenes more than others.
Yeah.
And those scenes, the ones you're talking about, I mean, those work spectacularly.
Well, so he was chosen at a casting call in Minneapolis from among 700 people. He was a limo driver and cell phone salesman. I looked at IMDb because I remember after the Oscars, there was a story that ran, I think, in the Minneapolis paper about how, despite that success, he really is broke and he still doesn't have any money. He didn't make a lot for that performance. So I was curious to see if he has anything in the works, at least according to IMDb. Listen to this. There is a movie coming out in 2015 called Trainwreck, in pre-production, written by the comedian Amy Schumer, directed by Judd Apatow, co-starring Tilda Swinton, Brie Larson, and Barkhad Abdi.
I don't think you were really on IMDb. I don't know where you were, but
that's what it says. That's what the internets tell me.
Well, let's hope Abdi has a little more fruitful Hollywood career than my number three pick. Though, by all accounts, this person's choice. It was their choice to leave Hollywood after having an experience after the one I'm going to talk about here. I'm talking about Jay Davidson in The Crying Game, who, after The Crying Game, played an alien or something like that in Stargate that wasn't quite as acclaimed. The Crying Game was one of those cultural shockwave films, and it really did have that feel when it came out in 1992, largely because of the way it subversively explored sexual identity and the way it forced audiences to do that when they thought they might have signed up for something completely different. Stephen Ray stars as an IRA operative who gets involved with Davidson's character, Dill. Now, Dill is the girlfriend of a British soldier that Ray had previously helped kidnap. So this is a complicated relationship already, but it becomes even more so when Ray's character discovers that Gil is a transgender woman, which initially repulses him, though he later finds he's still drawn to her. Now, to make this work, you're going to need someone who's going to be captivating to the audience no matter what sexual preference or gender identity they're bringing into the theater. You need someone with plain old movie charisma. And I think Davidson has that. That's what director Neil Jordan found. Davidson was working in fashion before The Crying Game, so he had no real acting experience, but he did have this sense of mystery. He had this unknowable quality in the movie. I think you especially sense it in the scene where Dill lip syncs Boy George's title song, and that's also the scene that really casts a spell over Ray's character. Like I said, from what I've read, the fact that after Stargate, he didn't really have any other movie projects was much more his own choice. But what we did get in The Crying Game was a pretty impressive performance, I thought.
We're here on Film Spotting, sharing our top five performances by non-professional actors. And as I was forming this list, you, of course, Josh, start to see certain directors who really like to work in this way. David Gordon Green, who directed Joe, we talked about in the first segment of the show, is someone who has done that at various points throughout his career, as he does in Joe. But it goes back to the Italian neorealists and guys like De Sica and Rossellini, Visconti, Pasolini, even with movies like Acatone. You do get then our memorial pick, Robert Bresson. Up to more modern filmmakers like Gus Van Sant, like Richard Linklater, those contemporary Iranian filmmakers like Panahi, Kiarostami, and Makhmalbaf. Ramin Barani is a recent filmmaker who makes great use of non-professionals. But of course, one of those filmmakers who really has experimented with this is the director of your number five pick, Gina Carano from Haywire. That's Steven Soderbergh, and he directed my number three pick as well. It's Debbie Dobryner from the movie Bubble, which I want to say was really his first foray into this kind of site-specific art where he was using non-professionals. The whole cast is non-professionals from the Ohio-West Virginia border, the location where the movie was shot. It really centers on this relationship between a middle-aged woman played by Dobryner, she's named Martha, and this 20-something stoner named Kyle. They work together at a doll factory, and they've got this pretty simple, mundane existence that's all disturbed by the arrival of a new employee, a younger woman named Rose, who's pretty attractive. She's a single mom. She develops a relationship of sorts with Kyle that Martha feels very threatened by, being friends with Kyle. And in doing some of the research for this list, looking for some of these picks that maybe were off the beaten path or I'd forgotten about, I found this quote from John Berger. He says, directors like Satyajit Ray, Rossellini, Bresson, Buñuel, Milos Forman, Scorsese, and Spike Lee have used non-professional actors precisely in order that the people we see on the screen may be scarcely more explained than reality itself. Professionals, except for the greatest, usually play not just the necessary role, but an explanation of the role. And I've considered that quote a bunch of different ways, starting out thinking it was brilliant to then totally pretentious and making no sense at all, and I'm back to brilliant. I think it does nail it in a way, if I'm understanding it right, which is they're saying that professionals, people who've done this a lot, have a tendency, perhaps, to play the psychology.
Speaks to an extra layer of effort.
Yeah, they show the psychology. They have really internalized this character. They've decided there's something they want to project to the audience. They aren't simply playing the character, and we're discovering them just like we would discover life itself. And this performance by De Bruyner, I think she does accomplish that. And it makes me think of Gary Poulter from Joe, which we talked about quite a bit, where I remember watching this movie Bubble and feeling like Kyle and Rose, the actress playing them, had probably never acted before. But De Bruyner, I thought she had to, just because she evoked this pure sense of being this character and having that sense of performance to it, but not in any kind of artificial way at all. She conveyed the sense of mystery, really, by not offering any type of explanation, not portraying the explanation. She simply exists on screen. Nothing feels false. And Soderbergh, I saw an interview with him. I don't know who he was talking about in this particular case or what movie, but he said the thing he likes about working with non-professionals is, unlike regular actors, they don't have goals. That gets back to that sense of the psychology and the explanation. They don't have goals when they step in front of that camera. And you really see that come through in De Bruyner's performance, a movie that relies on us not ever understanding what her goals might be. That is really the enigma that carries the entire film.
Probably the shot from Bubble that comes to mind when I think back on it is of De Bruyner. It's one that it's a little more due to Soderbergh than her, actually, where she's sitting in a church and it's all dark and all of a sudden the spotlight kind of comes down on her.
Yeah.
And you suddenly realize that she has these brilliant blue eyes mm-hmm. that have previously in the film had lost her ordinariness. So,
yeah,
that one is a good
prior
film.
To Bubble, Josh, she was a manager at a Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Okay.
In Parkersburg, West Virginia, worked there for 24 years. At this time, has not acted in any other film.
She's not in that film you found on IMDb with Abdi?
Trainwreck?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I didn't click on full cast and crew. You never know.
Might want to look into that. All right, my number two is probably the most common name to come up when I ask for suggestions on Facebook and on Twitter. It's Harold Russell in The Best Years of Our Lives. This is a beloved film that I finally had a chance to see because of this list, and a couple of listeners even mentioned it as one of their all-time favorites. It's a 1946 drama from director William Wyler, and it follows three World War II veterans as they return to the same quaint American town and try to adjust to civilian life. I don't know if I'd rank it quite as high as those listeners, but I'm in complete agreement with people who are wowed, and this includes the Academy Awards, by Harold Russell's performance as Homer Parrish. Russell won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar. Homer is a sailor who's returning to his fiance with great trepidation because he lost his hands when his ship was attacked. He now has a pair of hooks that he's learned to manipulate pretty expertly. This is clearly why Russell was cast. He did lose his own hands in a training accident and went on to be featured in a military film about rehabilitation, which brought him to the attention of Hollywood.
I'll be all right. I just got to work it out myself.
I could help you, Homer, if you'd let me.
I've got to work it out myself. All I've wanted is for people to treat me like anybody else instead of pitying me. I guess it's hard for them to do that. I've just got to learn to get used to it and pay no attention.
Couldn't I?
No, I've got to do it myself.
Now, this isn't a case necessarily of a natural talent being discovered. Again, if we use those traditional ways of judging performances, Russell's probably okay at best. Yet if he has occasionally stilted moments or line readings, I think they're easily overshadowed by the physical presence that he brings to this film. His performance it's a reminder to me that acting is more than a matter of believability or theatricality even. It can simply be a form of embodiment. And here it's the way Russell moves, positions himself when he's among others, or even just sits on a bed in this moment after his dad helps him disassemble the hooks from his arms for the night, and he's left there just sitting alone with what his life means now. I really like how Wyler leaves the camera on his upper body to keep us focused on the man, not on his disability. Russell does all of this with the heaviness of real-world experience, I think. He exudes the reality of a life with this disability in a way that Tom Cruise, you know, in Born on the 4th of July, or Gary Sinise in Forrest Gump, they just can't,
really?
No matter how talented they might be.
Well, they can't. Does it mean they're bad performances or just
not saying they're bad performances.
Not as authentic.
But it's just a whole different experience than watching this.
Well, I mentioned, Josh, that Barkhad Abdi was the third actor, non-professional, to get an Oscar nomination. Of course, Harold Russell was the first. The second, not on my list, Hang Nor from The Killing Fields, a film that unfortunately, just like The Best Years of Our Lives, I still need to see. So those were my big two regrets in putting this list together. My number two pick, I'm going back to Iranian cinema, and that probably makes sense. As we talked about a lot during that marathon, this film wasn't part of that marathon specifically. It was actually part of another, but those films, a lot of them really were these meta-narratives, and they were very experimental in their technique. And it does make sense that you'd have these filmmakers breaking down these walls, these traditional filmmaking walls, and would take risks and try things like putting non-professional actors on screen to carry a movie, as this actor does. He is Homayoun Irshadi from the Kiarostami film Taste of Cherry. The plot is about as simple and straightforward as you can get. He plays a middle-aged man who's driving around looking for someone he can convince to bury him after he takes his own life, and we follow him and the encounters he has with the three individuals he picks up. The story, according to Irshadi, is that he was an architect. He was just driving down the streets of Tehran one day, and it makes sense when you see how much driving is in Taste of Cherry that this is how he would go about getting cast. He rolled up to a red light, someone tapped on his car window, and it was Kiarostami, and he said, "I'm making a movie, I want you to be in it." It was as simple as that. And I don't really know what Kiarostami saw in him. Maybe it was just his presence. Maybe it was just that face. But one of the things I hinted at earlier with non-professional actors that I think maybe makes them stand out and makes them so good often on screen is that apparent lack of calculation, I think, sometimes can probably be attributed to the sense that they are really listening, which is, any actor will tell you, the most important part of acting, but maybe the toughest thing to do. They're not thinking, like most actors probably are, about their next line. They're not thinking about the different ways to approach that line. They're taking what they're given. They're responding in the moment. They don't have any craft, quote unquote, to fall back on, so they just have to rely on their instincts. And Irshadi is both a really focused, intense talker, though he doesn't raise his voice ever. That's what I think really makes him seem so focused, but also a really intense listener. And I think that draws us to him. And of course, when you see the whole film, it makes a lot of sense for his character because he has to get to know these people he's bringing into his car before he can bring up such an audacious and crazy sounding request. He has to come up with an idea of how he's going to approach it with these three vastly different people. He really does have to listen to know who they are and understand them as people. This is a movie that certainly has been and could be called boring. He plays a sedentary, quiet role that could be called boring, but Irshadi never is. And he's playing a desperate man without ever playing him in a desperate way. So wasn't surprised at all to do a little bit more research and find that I've actually seen this guy on screen. He was cast in Zero Dark 30 in a small role. He was in The Kite Runner a few years back. He's coming out in A Most Wanted Man, the Anton Corbijn film that stars Philip Seymour Hoffman in one of his last roles. So he's done something like 20 films in various roles since this part in Taste of Cherry. Not surprised at all if you see the movie.
When you talk about the listening aspect, it does make me wonder if working with non-professional actors, it's often the first take that's the best, because once all that thinking will come in on the second, third, fourth, and so on takes, you have to imagine, right?
Yeah.
So maybe filmmakers are able to capture it in the first take. I don't know. I'd have to look into some production details, see if that's the case. All right, my number one is a familiar name from this show, came up in our review of Joe. It's Gary Poulter, who plays Wade, the abusive father of the Ty Sheridan character. How good is Poulter as Wade? Well, David Gordon Green opens his film with a long, unbroken shot of just his face as Sheridan berates him. You don't see Sheridan, you see the back of his head while he's berating Wade for being a horrible father. In a way, Green risks his entire movie on Poulter right there, at least our first engagement with it. I think it pays off. Now, Poulter certainly has the part of this wandering, homeless father down in terms of looks. He's gaunt. He's got that weathered face that makes him look 20 years older than he likely is. I'm not sure what his actual age was while filming. Yet what Poulter brings to the role is ultimately less physical. I've talked about physicality a lot with these performances. He brings something almost spiritual here. He's this haunting specter who wanders the streets and the railroad tracks, seemingly in a fog, at least, until he zeroes in on his cravings, or they bubble up enough to give him a moment of foul clarity. In a way, you could almost say that Poulter navigates the various acting challenges of Joe in terms of who he's on screen with better than Nicolas Cage does. He does go toe-to-toe with Cage, who's the seasoned pro of the film, in a confrontation scene in Joe's truck. He also has really strong moments with Sheridan, this young actor who's still feeling his way on screen. And Poulter is absolutely seamless with the other non-professionals who make up Joe's work crew, especially in a confrontation scene there with a foreman of the crew. So Poulter is the real deal. But as you discussed with David Gordon Green in the interview, he died shortly after the filming of Joe. So this is all we're going to have of him on screen.
It really is tragic. Of course, it's tragic in many ways, but the fact that we're not going to be able to see him on screen ever again, you have to think that after a role like this, if he had chosen to, he definitely could have been cast in other films. It's a great pick, and it's one that if I wasn't so sure it was going to make your top five, probably would have found its way on my list, so consider Gary Poulter my number six. My number one, though, I'm going to go with a classic pick here. I mentioned Italian neorealist cinema hasn't come up yet to this point and really has to be talked about, even though there are so many different non-professional performances to consider, but I'm going to go with a big one here, Carlo Battisti from Umberto D. This is a movie that takes place in post-war Rome. He's a broke old man who's evicted from his apartment, trying to find a place to live that he can actually afford, along with his trusty dog, Flike. Battisti was a linguistics professor when he was cast, and I can only imagine that De Sica cast him for how distinguished and how intelligent he looked, because what adds to the heartbreak of watching this man struggle is this sense that he maybe could survive just barely if he could accept the hit to his pride. And it's not a pride that's born out of any kind of vanity, but just more an integrity. He really does embody this sense of integrity. And I think it's another non-professional performance similar to your number one Poulter in the sense that it doesn't purely get by on its stillness. He is a performer who's almost twitchy, but he's twitchy in a way that doesn't feel like it's something he developed for the performance. I think of the scene, Josh, where he does sink low enough to put his hand out on the street and beg for money as a man passes by. He's clearly conflicted about it, doesn't want to do it. The man walks by, he puts his hand out. Well, the man stops. Maybe he doesn't expect him to, but he does. And then as he comes back to get out some money to hand him, Battisti quickly looks away and turns his hand over as if maybe he was just looking at his fingernails or something, or admiring his hand outside. There's no natural way to pull that off, and it doesn't really feel natural. It's an awkward moment, like when someone catches you staring at them and then you quickly act like you're preoccupied and you weren't looking at them at all. He just goes with the awkwardness. And when there are scenes that you could describe as emotional and we get close-ups of his face, he doesn't do anything but exist on screen. He really conveys so much just by doing nothing at all, which is something I think that even most seasoned actors would have a hard time pulling off. He does here throughout the film. And another actor who had no other acting credits after this movie, didn't appear on screen again.
Yeah, that's a great one. Probably my number six. I think it's also an example of using a non-professional actor to express character through action rather than dialogue or other forms of expression. There's that long scene after he comes back to his room and his landlady has allowed a couple to use it while he was gone. So it's all in disarray. And the movie sticks with him for a few minutes while he puts everything back in its place. And I think that just suggests a couple things, his fastidiousness, of course, but also, you know, this idea of the pride that that you mentioned, the integrity. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, great performance.
Those are our top five performances by non-professional actors. Josh, what about any honorable mentions?
Well, if we didn't have the musicians band, I would have gone with Bjork, actually, and also Tupac Shakur in Juice. I didn't get a chance to do that list earlier, so there's my two options. I didn't have the athlete band, so I also considered Ray Allen in Spike Lee's He Got Game. And then a small film pick here of a couple of years ago, Ballast, a really strong performance there from Michael J. Smith. And then I also did have Debbie Dobryner from Soderbergh's Bubble as well.
For me, in addition to Poulter, I had Lamberto Maggiorani from The Bicycle Thief, the father there. And I did consider William Schimmel, or William Schimmel, the opera singer turned actor in another Kiarostami film, Certified Copy. But I do think, of course, Binoche is just so amazing in that film that he pales a little bit in comparison. He also didn't quite fit because, you know, I didn't know who he was, but he is an opera singer.
I was going to say, you do consider opera performing.
He's pretty dramatic. That's a performance, okay. I'm going to say. So really not a strong contender for my list. I'm sure there are many that I forgot, even with all my restrictions. Josh, we want to hear what you think. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out this weekend in wide release, a Disney documentary about an Alaskan bear family. It's called Bears.
Easy also, to remember.
Yeah. Transcendence. This is Johnny Depp as a terminally ill scientist who uploads his mind to a computer. I think the big reason a lot of people will be interested in seeing this film, though, is it is the directing debut from Wally Pfister, who is probably best known as Christopher Nolan's DP on the Dark Knight trilogy. Out in limited release, opening in Chicago and some other cities around the country. I'm going to get to the ones that we're most interested in. First, The Unknown Known. This is the Errol Morris documentary, his conversation with Donald Rumsfeld. If you've seen The Fog of War and that film with Robert McNamara, you might have an idea what this film is going after as well. It's a film I have seen, but it's technically a 2013 movie. I'm not sure we're going to devote an entire review to it, but it's a movie that I think does warrant some more discussion. I can recommend it as a film to see. Also out, Only Lovers Left Alive. This is Jarmusch, Vampires, Tilda Swinton, Tom Hiddleston, and one of my favorite young actresses, Mia Wasikowska. So those movies out now. Next week on the show, we may discuss Under the Skin. You heard my conversation with the director, Jonathan Glazer, last week on the show, and it's a movie, Josh, you still need to see when you do.
I've got plans, though.
There
I'm going to see it in a couple
days. You're
going
to see it, so we may devote a segment to it, or we may just stick with Only Lovers Left Alive, the Jarmusch film. Tying in with Under the Skin, either way, the top five we're kind of set on right now is top five things from space, and then in parentheses, that came to destroy us.
So are we going to limit it to that?
I think so.
That came to destroy us. So later we can do that came to help us out?
There you go.
Okay.
Top five things from space that came in peace. That's a future top five.
I like it. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week was from Black Lips. More information is at black-lips.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Did I kill some of your people, Kempinar? I can't remember.
We have an arrangement. Just like, promise me.
Those are like from two entirely different movies.
Josh, those you two won't lines. Touch Golden Joe Dassault.
I'm hungry.
Let's go.
Where's the intern? Sorry, I had not recovered yet.
No, you hadn't. And that could have been funny.